Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, it was 2 years ago that 20 first graders and six adults were killed by a troubled young man with an assault rifle. Media were transfixed by the disaster at Sandy Hook Elementary School, but did it affect the way they report on gun control? We'll talk about guns and the press with Ladd Everett, Communications Director at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Also this week, progressive Democrats launched an unexpected attack on a congressional spending bill, leaving some pundits complaining once more about nasty beltway polarization. But legislators were trying to do something substantive, stop an attempt to roll back an important part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform law. Journalist David Dayan will join us to explain what was at stake. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Corporate media like to warn Democrats that they need to move to the right. And that was the message in some of the coverage of Senator Elizabeth Warren's criticism of a somewhat sneaky plan to weaken a provision of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform law. In the Washington Post, Warren and company were dubbed the populist anti-Wall Street faction, opposing the, quote, can-do desires of establishment Democrats, close quote. Not only might they do something to upset Wall Street bankers, these progressive Democrats could spell trouble for Hillary Clinton's presidential ambitions, forcing her to, quote, take liberal positions that could hurt her in a potential general election contest, close quote. Another article in the Post framed the standoff as one that pits the more populist, purist elements of the base against the more pragmatic center. It's not hard to draw the lesson, can-do pragmatism versus dangerous, purist populism. But what exactly is this argument over again? It was a deal to, as we will talk about later in the show, remove some key regulations in order to benefit giant banks. In a more rational world, regulating Wall Street shenanigans would be considered centrist, and efforts to undo those regulations would be called something other than can-do pragmatism. But that's not the world corporate media inhabit.
The surprise White House announcement of a shift in Cuba policy prompted a lot of media discussion. Some of it seemed a little over the top, like the banner USA Today headline, Cuban Crisis Ended After 56 Years, or the Washington Post story that began, The Cold War Died Wednesday. Another Post article took the opportunity to belittle Cuba as, quote, a fly speck of an island that long ago ceased to be a threat to the United States, close quote. Well, one can argue about the extent of the Cuban threat to the U.S., but to call it a fly speck, literally speaking, bug excrement, is just inaccurate. Cuba is roughly the same size as Virginia, about 3.5 times as big as Maryland, and more than 600 times the size of the District of Columbia. Does the Post consider them fly specks as well? And then there was New York Times columnist Nick Kristof. He declared U.S. policy toward Cuba a decades-long failure, but he has a vision of how to bring about much-needed reforms there, the presence of more Americans. Quote, American tourists in Havana are already asking plaintively why Wi-Fi is so scarce or why the toilet paper is so rough. We need hordes of them, giggling at ancient cars held together with duct tape or comparing salaries with Cubans, close quote. So giggling Americans reminding Cubans that they're poor and have bad cars is going to do what exactly? Kristof closed with the hope that swarms of diplomats, tourists, and investors descend upon the island, preferably plump ones, he adds, which we guess will also show Cubans that Americans eat really well, too.
Well, coverage of the presidential race this early is bound to be, at best, annoying, at worst, something else. It continued in the wake of former Florida Governor Jeb Bush's announcement that he was exploring the possibility of running. This non-news made really big news. One Washington Post article said it, quote, instantly put the former Florida governor at the head of the pack, chasing the 2016 Republican nomination, close quote. Another Post article said it was thrusting him to the front of the pack. There is no pack, though, remember. No one is actually running yet, Bush included. A few days later, the Post's political reporter Dan Balls wrote that if Bush runs, he would be both a front runner and an underdog. Balls also noted that early polls show Bush in front, but that such numbers don't mean much. This is an odd observation from a journalist who just weeks ago devoted a whole piece to a poll that showed Mitt Romney was in the lead in a useless poll of early Republican contenders. There are a lot of stories that deserve attention right now. Campaign journalism like this reminds us that corporate media devote attention to the things that don't matter.
It's unusual to turn on a Sunday chat show and see a long report on U.S. drone attacks, and one that actually ponders critical questions like whether such attacks fuel terrorism and how many innocents are killed by U.S. strikes. But that is what viewers of Meet the Press saw on December 14th. The segment still had its problems, though, particularly on what might be the most important issue, who is dying. For NBC, it's basically unknowable. Here's how correspondent Richard Engel put it.
The secretive nature of the program means no one can tell for sure how many of the estimated 3,500 people killed, mostly in Pakistan and Yemen, were insurgents and how many were innocent civilians.
But there are never certain casualty figures in any war. What we do have, though, are efforts to document the deaths in these and other countries. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism, one of the groups counting and in many cases naming the dead, reports between 400 and 900 civilian deaths in Pakistan alone. Reporters trying to tackle these issues should do more than throw their hands up. At the end of the segment, host Chuck Todd actually wondered if, in 10 years, we could be finding out we droned innocents. There's no need to wait, though, unless you don't really want people to know now.
And finally, Fox host Bill O'Reilly weighed in on the siege in a Sydney, Australia cafe, using it as an opportunity to make some familiar points.
In Sydney, Australia today, Muslim fanatic apparently kills two, injures four others before police shoot him dead. Another lone wolf terror attack that we're seeing all over the world. So far, all the wolves have been Muslims.
Of course, anyone who follows the news knows that every lone wolf terrorist has not been Muslim. Some have been motivated by right-wing politics. A 2008 attack on a progressive church in Tennessee. A white supremacist shooting two Jewish community centers in Kansas City. Anders Breivik killing 76 people in Norway because he was apparently terrified about the spread of Islam. So O'Reilly is wrong, of course, but he's wrong in the service of bolstering certain political views, namely supporting war and torture.
If you're not going to use drones, tough interrogations, ground troops, or detention centers, how are you going to stop the madness? The answer is, you're not going to stop the madness. The jihadists are going to continue to attack, and you are going to have to absorb the punishment they distribute.
The thing is, the United States is doing all of those things right now, and yet there are still, as O'Reilly acknowledges, terror attacks. Perhaps he's confusing the cure with the cause.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It was 2 years ago this week that a troubled young man killed 20 children and six adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School with an AR-15 rifle. For many, the tragedy was only a particularly devastating example of the need to restrict access to such high-powered weaponry. For others, though, every gun killing is paradoxically more reason Americans need more guns. So while some expected Sandy Hook to lead to increased support for gun control, it hasn't exactly panned out that way. How to move forward? Here to discuss the state of gun legislation is Ladd Everett. He's director of communications at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Ladd Everett.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to start with this public opinion poll, because virtually every commemorative story on Sandy Hook mentioned a new Pew Research Center poll that seemed to show support for gun rights at a high. I wonder, what are your thoughts on the poll itself and on public opinion on this issue?
Well, I think the types of questions you ask in these polls matters a great deal. Basically, in this poll that Pew did, people were being asked to choose between having rights or being controlled. That was the way the questions were worded. Do you want to have gun rights or do you want gun ownership to be quote unquote controlled? I think language does matter. And I think no matter what topic you're polling folks about, you know, rights are going to be more popular than the notion of being controlled. I also think if we're being honest, I think the gun lobby, particularly the NRA, has done a great job of damaging the term gun control over the years and having Americans kind of now associate immediately those words with extreme proposals, which don't exist in reality, but with the extreme notion of, let's say, doing away with all guns. What I thought was fascinating is just the other day, another polling firm, Strategies 360, replicated the poll, but they asked the question just a little bit differently. They said, what do you think is more important, to protect the right of Americans to own guns or to make it harder for people who are dangerous or severely mentally ill to get guns? When they asked it in that fashion, not too different from the original question, just not using that controlling language, they found out that 35% of respondents said protecting gun rights was more important. 63% said keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous individuals were important. So with polling like this, you know, words matter, language matters. You know, Pew's in a situation here where they've been using this kind of outdated language for decades. They're also putting up this kind of false test for people that you can't be both for protecting gun rights and sensible gun legislation. The truth is the overwhelming majority of gun owners are for sensible gun legislation to keep guns out of the wrong hands. They get it. They understand that with rights come responsibilities. So there's certainly some data that gun violence prevention activists should look about in this poll. I think the stuff that probably would concern us more is the growing percentage of Americans right now that feel that a gun in the home makes them safer, including a pretty sharp increase there among African Americans. So, you know, I think there's some things in there that we need to look at and need to take into account. But the general question about rights and being controlled, I don't think worries me much, because when you just very simply rephrase that, those numbers come back into balance pretty quickly. And then let's also keep in mind, too, that when you ask people about specific gun control policies, like requiring background checks on gun sales or requiring lost and stolen guns to be reported, you're still seeing overwhelming majority of Americans support those policies.
Can you bring us up to speed on efforts, legislative or otherwise, to decrease gun violence? Did Sandy Hook have any impact, or any of the other incidents of gun violence have an impact on policy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You can start by looking at some of the tremendous changes that occurred in state legislatures across the country in the months following Sandy Hook. You know, you can look at states like Maryland, the incredible changes that were made in Colorado, other states like New York, California, Delaware, red states like Wisconsin and Louisiana tightening laws concerning domestic abusers who have guns. I mean, there's just been remarkable progress really across the map, and we're very happy about that. And then getting back to the question of polling and how people view gun reform, we can also, I think, look back on this election that just occurred with a great amount of satisfaction. Most specifically, I would point to the approval of the I-594 referendum in Washington, and Washington now becomes the latest state with a universal background checks. They were able to approve that there with, I think, 59% or 60% of Washington residents voting for it in a midterm election that was otherwise a GOP wave election. So I think that's a really good sign for us. An additional good sign for us was the fact that two of our greatest champions of gun violence prevention in the wake of Newtown, Democrats John Hinkenlooper in Colorado and Daniel Malloy in Connecticut, held their seats. So I think there's a lot of good signs that we're seeing. The most recent one, of course, would be the confirmation of Vivek Murthy the other day, a vote that the NRA scored, made it very public that they were going to score that vote. No one cared at the end of the day. We won that vote pretty easily. I'll tell you what, we're very optimistic about moving forward to 2016. We've seen a lot of change so far. What we saw on the second anniversary of Newtown in terms of how this movement looks is that there's been no loss of momentum whatsoever. In fact, the week leading into the second anniversary, we had what was called a week of action across the movement with ground events literally in states across the country, culminating in a huge second vigil for victims of gun violence at the National Cathedral. So I think we're running on all cylinders. I'm not going to mislead your listeners and act as if this is going to be easy work. It's not going to be easy work. Nothing that ever really matters in this country is easy work, but we're making what I would argue is very good progress, and we'll get there.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Vivek Murthy, because he is the new Surgeon General, although it didn't come about in the most straightforward way. The opposition to him was largely based on the fact that He stated that gun violence was a public health issue. That seems like a useful reframing of the issue.
Well, I think there's been some debate about that. There's certainly debate within our movement about whether framing the issue as a public health issue is productive. I think what people need to realize is they act as if that's a novel approach. It's not. It's the way, really, that our movement framed the issue for, I don't know, the first at least two or three decades of its existence, and it didn't do much for us. If you look at the way the NRA framed the issue at that point, it was very different. They framed it as a values issue, right? It was all about freedom and liberty and self-reliance and all these types of kind of core American values that, as opposed to touching the brain, touch the gut. And I think there's a lesson in there for us. Data is not going to win people over eventually. What's going to win people over is a feeling that the advocacy that you are asking them to invest in is reflective of who they are, what they care about, their values as an American. I think we need to speak about the issue in very personal terms. I think we need to tell the very powerful personal stories of victims and survivors, and we are doing that across this movement. One of the things that our organization has done, and I think we're a pioneer in this area, is we have to be willing, very willing, to have a conversation about democratic values with the NRA, with pro-gun activists. And we have to beat back against their insurrectionist interpretation of the Second Amendment and explain to America why that is utterly corrosive to our democratic enterprise here in this country under the Constitution.
Finally, as you talk with reporters, what are some of the ideas or questions you come up against that frustrate or concern you? Or what do you make of media coverage of this issue in general?
I think it's pretty thorough for the most part. I think what frustrates me a little bit is a lack of follow-through in terms of finding out where crime guns came from, right? I mean, we have so many situations where we have grotesque shootings. We hear a little bit about the past criminal and or mental health history of a shooter. And then for some reason, we never get the follow-through we need and find out where that individual got the gun. You want to understand how it happened, and you want to be able to diagnose a reform where you could shut down the channel through which these folks are getting guns, particularly when they're sending up obvious red flags ahead of the fact and making it clear that they were dangerous and a threat to themselves or others. And I don't want to act as if that's easy. I think what we need to understand is the NRA backs private sales because they can't be monitored and because private sellers can't be held accountable for those sales. So tracing those sales is sometimes very difficult. But that's what we need investigative journalists for, to kind of enlighten us on what policies might have stopped these shootings. I think the media can really serve a valuable role there in better informing us about policies to stop these shootings. Too often we don't get that piece. Too often reporters are not being aggressive in following through with the courts and law enforcement and finding out where these guns came from. I think Americans have a right to know that when there's a shooting in their neighborhood. They absolutely have a right to know basically what loophole these people are walking through. And in almost all cases, they are walking through one of the enormous loopholes in our gun laws.
We've been speaking with Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. You can find them on the web at csgv.org. Thank you very much, Ladd Everett, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Pleasure talking to you.
Seemingly out of nowhere, a fight broke out in Congress last week over a spending bill that was dubbed the Cromnibus. Critics, particularly progressive Democrats, placed most of their attention on a provision that would undercut one of the key regulations of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform law. So how did weakening Wall Street reform get mixed up in a measure to fund the government? David Dayan has traced the history of this for Salon.com in a piece headlined Inside Wall Street's New Heist. He joins us now. David, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you wrote that this was a horrible bill even without this rollback, but that was the provision that got most of the attention, and for good reason. Explain what this rollback of Section 716 means to people.
Yeah, Section 716 was put into the Dodd-Frank law to separate out the riskiest derivative bets. Now, derivatives played a key role in driving the 2008 financial crisis. And under this law, you, as a financial institution, would not be able to trade those derivatives inside the depository unit of your bank, which is eligible for FDIC deposit insurance. You would have to split that out into a separate unit, subsidiary, that is separately capitalized, where the bank itself would be on the hook for any mistakes, anything goes wrong, if those trades go bad. So that's the idea, is to insulate the government from having to bail out these banks. And what this really does is it eliminates a subsidy. Because of Section 716, if it's in a separately capitalized entity, borrowers know that they could actually lose their money if they lend money to this subsidiary institution. Whereas in a case where they're, you know, set up for a bailout inside the FDIC depository insurance unit, then they will lend money at a cheaper rate. So really, we're talking about a subsidy that was eliminated in Dodd-Frank, and because of that, the banks really wanted to restore that subsidy to increase their profits.
And one of the things I understood from your piece that I didn't get from a lot of the news accounts was that this was an ongoing project of some of the big banks, that this did not just spring up out of nowhere.
That's right. Ongoing for maybe 4 years. In many senses, as soon as the provision was inserted into Dodd-Frank, it was originally actually much more expansive. Blanche Lincoln, who had oversight over derivatives in the Senate, put in this amendment, and it actually would have forced many more derivatives out into this subsidiary. But in the Dodd-Frank Conference Committee, it got limited to just 5% of all swaps, the riskiest bits, basically. And a coalition of lobbyists and Republican members of the House Financial Services Committee and even some Democrats have been trying to eliminate Section 716 for many years. And these bills have passed the Republican-controlled House on two separate occasions. The last time was 70 Democrats also in support, and it was pretty much well known inside Washington that at some point this would get attached to what is known as a must-pass vehicle, something that was going to pass anyway, and you sort of stick this provision on like a barnacle on a ship, and it's off and running, and the idea is that politicians will not worry about one provision when there's a lot of other things that they might want in that bill. And that ends up to be how it got passed.
And you can take a cynical view of politics, but then you read that this language was actually drafted by Citibank itself. And
that's correct.
And you think that
the New York Times did a very good story where they found that 70 of the 85 lines in the bill were written by Citibank lobbyists. And ultimately that bill, which was the bill that passed Congress, was identical to the language that was thrown in what is known as a rider in the year-end budget bill.
Now, there are people, I think even people who agree on many of these things, who say, yes, this is bad, but it's not as big a deal. I think Paul Krugman at the New York Times is one of them. He says, you know, this isn't worth the political fight over Section 716. What do you think of that argument, that this sure is bad, but it's maybe not as bad as people fear?
Well, I think it is a big deal for two reasons. Number one, this is just a giant subsidy to major banks. And what we saw in a lot of the riders were that they were just handouts to wealthy or well-connected corporate interests that ended up getting breaks through the appropriations process, and we shouldn't be facilitating that. And that's really the key second point, which is this sets a precedent of rolling back regulations and policies inside spending bills that are unrelated to those policies. And this precedent, I fear, is going to be the way that Congress conducts business over the next 2 years. And now that the president has signed off on this bill, now that Congress seems interested in doing it, it's really a blueprint for how bills like and important laws like Dodd-Frank are going to get rolled back through Congress. And now that we've seen that this is how it'll work, you can expect more of this in the future.
Now, the narrative in the political press is that this is a problem for Democrats. Elizabeth Warren is leading a left-wing Tea Party insurgency, as the Washington Post's Dana Milbank is warning. That seems pretty premature, but this drama does suggest that there is some kind of real split or fight inside the Democratic Party, not necessarily just over this, but over these kinds of policies overall.
Yeah, I think there is maybe not a split, but there's certainly a lot of insularity. I mean, the reason that this got passed is that it got stuck into this appropriations bill. And the appropriations committee is just so notoriously insular and secretive in its dealings that it was basically done in a one-on-one negotiation between the heads of the House and Senate Appropriations Committee, and Barbara Mikulski, being the leading Democrat on the Senate side, decided the horse trade and got like a little bit of more money for the regulator that has jurisdiction over these derivatives in exchange for eliminating some of the, you know, the regulations that they actually can conduct. So, and thought that was a pretty good deal. Now, Barbara Mikulski is not someone who's on the banking committee. She doesn't have a strong history of understanding the very complex maneuvers that banks undergo. And yet she was given all of this power to make these policy changes within this appropriations bill. And that's a problem, just a structural problem for Congress. And it works to the benefit of lobbyists who probably know more about this stuff than the lawmakers who get to vote on it.
We've been speaking with David Dayan. You can read his piece, Inside Wall Street's New Heist, How Big Banks Exploited a Broken Democratic Caucus, at Salon.com. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin, David Dayan.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.